Hello there, podcast listeners. In this new season of the podcast, we're investigating the far-reaching effects of COVID in our daily lives. This episode is about pandemic and book publishing. There are updates from the publishing industry and a very personal story of an Indian writer. Today, I have with me my host, Stephanie Reibel, who's a published writer herself, among other things, joining me from the US. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Pratap. It's so good to see you.
So good to see you too. Stephanie, how have you been?
I think I've been good. I've been really looking forward to this episode because I feel like this has been something that has really heightened during the pandemic. So many people are reading books, and we kind of have this, at least in the academic community, kind of a split between folks that have been very productive writing-wise during the pandemic and people that have been not at all, especially because of kids and personal lives and other things. So I'm really interested to hear a little bit about the publishing industry and a personal perspective.
Okay, so let's also plug your book. When did you publish your book? Didn't your book also come out quite recently?
Yes, it did. So I was in one side of this camp. I was someone who ended up being pretty productive during the pandemic in my writing. So I ended up writing actually fully during the pandemic. I started writing in March, conveniently, of 2020. I was scheduled to start writing in March, February time. And then it just got published in February of 2022. And the book is basically about social entrepreneurship, and it is an academic textbook, but at the same time, it's very friendly and readable, so a lot of practitioners might be interested as well.
That's brilliant. Jane Friedman, this first interview that we're going to hear, is a publishing industry expert. She's been in the industry for about 20 years. She has a few newsletters for promising authors. One of them is a paid newsletter. It's quite popular. And she talks about how the transition to digital in terms of book publishing and selling has always been happening, but the pandemic kind of accelerated it. Now, let's listen to Jane Friedman, what Jane Friedman has to say about how the publishing industry coped during the pandemic.
Most of my work in some form involves educating authors and also just reporting on trends and news in the publishing industry for a wide audience. So that could include agents, freelancers, service companies, small presses. So for instance, recently I, wrote about the effect TikTok is having on book sales and how publishers are using TikTok and more broadly how social media is playing a role in book marketing campaigns. So these are the sorts of things that I write about. Some of this material is free, some of it's, part of my paid newsletter. And then I also run classes. Some of them I teach, but most of them are by guest instructors on craft, technique, business, things to help professional authors do better, to write better, publish better, and sell more books.
Earlier last year, you wrote this extensive article, a sort of like a rebuttal to a piece about how the publishing industry is dealing with the pandemic. The article stated that a lot of retailers are struggling, especially a lot of indie retailers are struggling. But you wrote an optimistic overview of the whole scenario. It's been a year now. Is there an update on that?
Well, book sales have never been better for book publishing. In fact, it's historic levels of sales, up 9% over 2020 and up an even greater amount over 2019. So if you just look at it from a sales perspective, things could not be better. Now, it's reasonable to ask who is benefiting from those increased sales. And a lot of the big publishers are. Amazon is benefiting. There has been a shift to online sales that mainly puts more power in the hands of Amazon, which generally people don't like to hear that. They want Amazon to have less power, not more power. But something else that happened during the pandemic was an independent retailer called Bookshop launched in January 2020, very serendipitously. They didn't know the pandemic was coming, but it was the perfect time for them to be launching because everyone was shifting to online purchasing.
Okay, so that has been a major development in the publishing industry.
Yes. I mean, it was already, sales were already moving online. The pandemic accelerated that.
Okay. And you also talk about in your piece, you also talk about how the fortune of self-published writers have changed. Many of them are reporting extensive sales in the previous years. Is that so? This year, in 2021, has that continued?
For self-published authors, it's a little harder to know exactly how they're doing because their sales aren't reported through traditional channels. So like all of the figures I've been talking about so far come from a company called BookScan. And there are parts of the market they can't see. So mainly we're talking about digital sales that happen through Amazon that don't go through any other retail service. So the books aren't widely distributed outside of the Amazon ecosystem. This would include things like Kindle Unlimited, which is where a lot of self-published authors have their work available. But, you know, the self-published authors have, you know, the community seems as healthy and as robust as ever. And generally speaking, subscription services, digital buying, all of those saw increased activity in the last couple of years. We'll see if that continues this year. Some people are expecting some of those subscription services to maybe level off. But I mean, again, the growth of these services, like the all-you-can-eat or read services, they were starting to ramp up prior to the pandemic. So again, the pandemic just accelerated something that was already happening.
Not only a purchase of books have sort of moved online because of the pandemic, would you also say people have started reading ebooks as opposed to print books? Is that fair to say?
Mm-hmm. In 2020, especially, there was more digital uptake because of all of the lockdowns and stores being closed. So in some cases, especially in Europe, people had no choice but to try digital formats when before they refused. So we did see increased adoption on the ebook side, but we haven't seen the same in 2021. So the ebook sales started to come back down. That said, a lot of people tried something they weren't willing to try before, and I think that's going to have long-term effects. They may have, for instance, in Europe, they may have tried a subscription service like Storytel. In the United States, they may have tried Kindle Unlimited or Scribd, or they may have tried their library digital lending program. So you have a lot more experimentation going on. And I think some of that behavior is going to carry through.
How has it been for you in the past 2 years? Has it been transformative in any way? Has it affected your work or has it not changed at all?
I was working predominantly online before the pandemic. So what I saw was just more people joining me where I was already active. So I was offering online classes and email newsletters. And those are two things that have done very well since 2020, just because people have little else to do or they've been forced to try things when there are no other options available.
Yeah. So you've been a champion for migrating to digital for a long time with your hot sheet newsletter as well. Has there been like an increase in interest in your newsletters, for newsletters like yours or other products like yours because of the pandemic in the past 2 years?
I think the tools have played a bigger role there than the pandemic itself. You're just seeing a lot of writers of all backgrounds, especially journalists and nonfiction pundits, critics, commentators, you know, they're finding new avenues for building their own readership that doesn't depend on having an employer or, you know, having someone who pays them a salary. They find that if they can attract the audience themselves, then maybe they don't need an institution standing behind them. There's probably an excess of enthusiasm right now. There are more people jumping into that than I think are going to stick around. But that, you know, that happens with anything that's new and exciting. People want to try it out and then they realize it's not for them and they kind of revert maybe to some in-between state or they go back to their old employment. So we'll see.
Would you think that? Because this migration to social media, this migration to online was always going to happen in some form or another, would you say?
Certainly, yes. If I look back on the last 20 years and what has had the most effect, it has to be Amazon. I don't know that you could point to any other company or dynamic that has so fully changed publishing from top to bottom. And the pandemic just weighted things more in that direction. The other thing that's happened is it's shown the weakness of the supply chain for book publishing in particular. The supplies of both paper and printing time, there has never been a tighter supply in the entire history of the industry at a moment when demand is higher than ever. So you can imagine this is a very frustrating moment for publishers who can sell more, but they can't print more. And these are things that predate the pandemic. The pandemic made them worse. They're not going to get better anytime soon. And this is a global issue, too. It's not just U.S. book publishers. It's anyone who uses China. It's anyone who has books on a container ship. It's anyone who just needs paper for book printing.
Yeah. Has the supply chain issue been sorted? Is it eased out? Or is it still at the same level as we experienced it in 2020 or 21?
I mean, for book publishers, it's just as bad right now as it was last year. And part of it is just because there's been a lot of consolidation of printers and paper suppliers. Again, here, Amazon plays this strange role in that they have to manufacture a lot of boxes and packaging. And so that is more profitable for some paper suppliers and printers to produce.
Oh, wow.
Than book paper. So, you know, you've got all of these manufacturers converting over to making Amazon supplies and not making books. It's, okay. I don't think people realize book publishing is like a tiny, tiny percentage of the overall printing and paper market. And so they don't like have all of this weight or leverage. They're trying to do what they can.
Wow, that's so interesting. So speaking of Amazon, do you also have any specialized lessons on Kindle Direct Publishing? Do you educate authors on that as well?
There are a couple of sites and services that track trends on Amazon Kindle. And I definitely keep up to date on those reports, and then I share the high-level findings in my newsletter. I mean, some of this is a little bit of hocus-pocus because we can't know exactly what's happening on Amazon because they don't share their numbers in that sort of granular way. But you can always see sales ranks of books and how it's shifting. And there's a rule of thumb about sales rank and sales volume. So these services and people who come up with these trend reports are scraping those rankings and applying their calculus to tell people, oh, dystopian is on a downward trend, or everyone's now buying climate fiction. Self-publishers are the ones who are really paying close attention because they're more likely to write to market, but traditional publishers don't. I wouldn't say that they really care that much, because they're just as concerned with the broader print market and bookstore market, not just what's doing well on the Amazon.
Okay. So I was just speaking to an author who's based in India, who's also a self-published author, and she uses this Kindle Direct Publishing extensively, but she still says, I cannot crack the code of this direct publishing. I don't know what Amazon's algorithm wants, but it seems like romance stories are selling for her.
Romance is the biggest category by far. I think it's romance followed by mystery, thriller, suspense, then science fiction, fantasy, if you look at just volume of sales happening on Amazon. So yeah, there is a ton of romance being published. And even in categories that aren't affiliated with romance, you see romance creeping in through like melding or blending of different genres.
And also speaking of social media, do you think even traditional publishers are now embracing social media as a tool to sell books, promotion on Instagram, TikTok? I think that has caught on. Do you think so too?
It really depends on the publisher and the publicity and marketing department. You know, the bigger publishers definitely have teams in place that are analyzing and using social media like in a very data-informed manner. But some others, you know, are still very traditional in how they market and promote a book. Like they're looking for bookseller and librarian influence and buy-in, and trying to get word of mouth through who is speaking about the book, rather like influencers and big names, rather than, say, making a more grassroots effort. Although the best campaigns are going to use a 360-degree approach. They're going to be looking at social media as well as bookstores, libraries, and influencers. I think where things sometimes fall apart is, like, there was a recent New York Times article about how social media doesn't sell books.
Yeah.
Which is like the complaint that's been going on for years and is kind of silly. But the article in question was looking at, you know, really big celebrities who've released books, and they have these huge social media followings, yet the sales are kind of not what you would expect given their millions of followers. But this just, you know, the whole premise of that article was kind of flawed in that I don't know that any publisher expects that a huge social media following automatically leads to book sales. So, you know, it can be tempting to sign celebrities and think that their followers will buy the book, but without a meaningful campaign, you have to apply effort. It just doesn't happen in and of itself.
Yeah, true. But like book clubs, Oprah's book club and Reese Witherspoon's book, they've always been popular among readers, haven't they?
There is something of like a book club renaissance going on. I think that some of it might relate to the pandemic and that people were just looking for sources of connection. But there are lots of startups right now in the book club area. There's like Literati, which is doing quite well, a startup based in Texas. There's literally a site called Book Club. It's bookclub.com, and they're trying to be the masterclass of book clubs. There's an app called Fable, and there are at least two or three others. So there are a lot of people like looking at Reese Witherspoon and looking at Jenna Bush, who does book club picks, and some others, and trying to create, you know, something that would equal the Oprah effect. I don't know that anyone has quite achieved that effect. I'm not sure if it's even possible anymore with the fragmentation in the market. But yes, book clubs are kind of coming back in what I would call a hybrid form. Like there's some digital components, some live components to it.
True. This is so interesting to know about the revival of book clubs.
Yeah, it feels like there's a book club for every possible niche you can imagine. Why there's so much startup money going into it right now is hard for me to say. But yeah.
So I'm trying to imagine what would be the financial aspect of it, as in how are these apps trying to make money out of a book club? Do they think publishers would pay them to promote the books, or?
I mean, that's possible, but the ones that I've seen are mainly relying on readers willing to pay an annual or monthly fee to have access to, you know, these influencer recommendations or access to small group chats, or some of them have an e-commerce component where you're actually buying the book. But I think a lot of it is just expecting people to pay for some sort of special experience they can't get elsewhere. But normally that's not how it's worked in book publishing. Normally, you know, the club stuff is free.
Absolutely.
And you use that to sell the book. So it's, I don't have a lot of grand expectations for how these are going to go. I just don't see, people don't want to pay that much. They want to spend their money on books, not clubs.
Yeah. As long as it sells books, everything is kosher, I think. And we're in the second year of the pandemic. Are things going back to normal in terms of publishing in the US? Are there readings happening, book release events happening? How are they?
It depends on what part of the country you're in.
Okay.
So, you know, there are like areas, you know, say in the South where you could totally host events and it would be fine. There are other areas like in New York or maybe in the Pacific Northwest where it's really a non-starter and you're not going to get anyone to host it, or you wouldn't get good attendance. So we're in kind of a weird in-between stage. Who knows how long that will last. But in terms of events, it's not back to normal. But a lot of people, you know, are now comfortable thinking about author tours or author events or launches that take more of a hybrid approach, kind of like we discussed earlier, where there's going to be an in-person component and an online component. So,
okay. What are your hopes for 2022? Do you have any, do you think any trends will catch on this year?
I think TikTok will continue to be talked about as just a phenomenon that helps books sell. It's shown a lot of significant power to bring older books back to life. And by older, I mean things that just, they weren't released this year. It's fascinating to watch the enthusiasm of book talkers sending books onto the bestseller list after several years. Everyone's closely watching whether or not Penguin Random House will be allowed to acquire Simon & Schuster. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So there's the Department of Justice here in the U.S. has has tried to block the deal. That trial will likely happen this year. It'll be nice for that to have resolution. So I think those are the two areas that we're kind of waiting to see what happens.
And lots of book sales.
Yes, yes.
I would love to hear a little bit of your perceptions, because you are someone that is a writer yourself, in terms of how you've experienced any sort of transition to digital media as someone who reads quite a bit, how you've been able to, you know, kind of participate, or what you've been noticing, especially since you've been living in Europe as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So in terms of reading, I was one of the early adapters of reading ebooks. I still have my second edition Kindle that I bought like 10 years ago. It has keyboards. It's a clunky device, but it has keyboards, and it's very nostalgic. So I still have that with me. So I have transitioned to reading ebooks. Like 50% of my yearly reading is on my electronic device. Also, my writing is mostly just digital right now. It's very rarely that I write for print publications. So the pandemic's role in it, I'm not entirely sure. This has been happening for quite a few years.
Well, have you been involved in any book clubs? I know that you've said that you've been reading quite a bit, but have you been flexing in the community on this as well?
No. So since I live in this really small city in Germany that doesn't have a lot of English-speaking population, that hasn't been an outlet for me to explore. But I was part of a book club back in Frankfurt 2 years ago, when the pandemic started. They migrated online because they couldn't meet physically anymore. But then they went back again to physical meetups right after the regulations were slightly relaxed. I would actually really enjoy being part of a book club, I think, but I also have Zoom fatigue, I want to say. It's a different experience to go to a cafe and meet like-minded people who have read the same books and dissect a particular book. And it feels like a chore if you have to go online and you know, even if it's a friendly conversation, it somehow feels like a chore to me.
Yeah, I can see that, especially because I'm in Zoom meetings all day as well. I've been getting notifications of a book club that I wanted to join aspirational style during the pandemic. However, have I attended once? No. Have I read the books? No. And I think it's to that same point that I think as of now, I'm craving more of a human connection rather than just being on Zoom calls. But I can completely see how it created a sense of community for people that were really avid book lovers, whereas I feel like I've created other senses of community, even with Record of Change.
So the next person that I interviewed is Anjali Vajid, who is a Bangalore-based writer who is so prolific that she would give many of us complex. The day before I talked to her, she had published her 33rd novel. And she also talked to me about how she channel her grief because she did lose a loved member of her family during the pandemic. So she talked about that, and she talked about how writing was cathartic for her, and she wrote an article about that process. So let's listen to Anjali.
I've been writing for a long time, since I think 1999, but my first novel got published in the year 2009. It took me some time, a couple of years at least, to sit and sort through what I wanted to write. And I was still not sure. I was a very confused person. And by the end of 2 years, I think I had finished writing my first novel, which I called Kite Strings. And it took me another 3 years to find a publisher for it. So I was kind of stuck until that first book got published. So once that got published, it kind of started exploring different facets in my writing. I write popular fiction. I write lighthearted novels, which people like to, you know, read to kind of get away from whatever it is, you know, the humdrum life or whatever. So I enjoy writing those sort of books. I enjoy reading those sort of books. So in between, in 2014, I took up another job as the head of marketing at a software company. And I worked there for a year. It was a good experience. But I realized then that I really didn't want to do anything I mean, I really wanted someone to pay me to write my books. And that wasn't really happening. And that was until I rediscovered self-publishing on Amazon. I had tried it. I had attempted it in 2012 for my first novel. I took the rights back from the publisher and put it up on Amazon. But I didn't do a good enough job of it. So in 2019, I decided to take the plunge into self-publishing once more. And it's been great, you know, it's been great because I can write as much as I want and readers are always hungry for more. So, you know, it has helped me expand my reader base. I do publish with publishers like, you know, so last year, two of my books came out with Penguin and Duckbill. So I do publish traditionally also. But at the same time, I enjoy the freedom that self-publishing gives me because I don't want to be controlled by a certain number of books that I'm supposed to bring out in a year. And like, you know, so what am I supposed to do with myself the rest of the time? So basically, this is me. I have been writing since 2009 officially. And yesterday, my 33rd novel got published.
Oh, wow. Congratulations. Is this maybe this time
yes,
now? Is
that the you. Book? Yes, yes.
You say that your writing style is pretty unconventional because you're so prolific and you want to publish more books per year. And traditional publishing doesn't allow, there's no room for such writing and such frequency of books in traditional publishing.
Yes.
How many books do you write in a year? Now, of the 33 books, how many books have you written per year if you have to take stock?
I don't want to say this. You know, it could be around, say, 6 to 7 books a year.
Okay. What is your process like? How many hours in a day do you write? Do you write like 5 hours or like a typical work day?
Yeah, so I don't write based on the time. But what I like to do is... once I make a plan for a book, I come up with a rough synopsis with the character details and all that. What I like to do is I like to devote, say, a chapter or two a day. You know, if I have time, I come back and write one more chapter. But I have other things to do, other responsibilities. So normally I try and get the writing done the first thing in the morning. Maybe I would try and write around 2,000 to 3,000 words a day.
Okay. Are you sometimes in parallel working on multiple projects at the same time?
I've tried this, but it's not easy, you know. I feel like for me, when I'm writing a book, I want to make sure that I get the voice of the characters perfectly. And I don't want to be so, I mean, as it is, I do feel like I'm living with these characters in my head. So I can't have multiple sets of them running around in my head at the same time.
So for someone like you who writes at least 3,000 words a day, that's a lot more than what so many other writers can claim. For you, this pandemic, when COVID hit and when everyone went on lockdown, how did that transition work for you initially?
It was very frustrating because I was used to the idea of sending my kids off to school. And, you know, sitting down and having the freedom to write till they came back. But with everyone at home. So, you know, I think as I've grown older, I've become more sensitive to being unable to write when I'm in a noisy environment. Earlier, I could do it with my kids clambering all over me. But as I've grown older, I just feel more comfortable if I have my desk and if I have silence, then I feel I'm more productive. So initially, it was quite disturbing physically in the sense I couldn't concentrate. I couldn't figure out since, you know, everyone is at home all the time. Then of course, you have to learn to also look at the, you know, the bright side of it and that people are safe and, you know, everyone's safe at home. So that was the idea which I kind of eventually got used to the idea of, you know, the kids being at home and figuring out what to do with them and all that. So they're not small kids, they're bigger kids only. So, you know, so it's all right. So it was initially a little difficult, but we got used to it.
Okay. Did it affect your writing or publishing schedule in any way?
Not really. The books that were supposed to come out in 2020 got pushed to 2021. The ones with the, you know, what came out last year with Penguin and Duckbill. By 2020, I had already self-published around 4 or 5 books. And I kind of got the whole, you know, the feel of it and the idea of how this works. And since I had already started self-publishing, I didn't feel the pinch so much. Like a lot of writers have discovered that publishing has taken a huge hit. You know, traditional publishing, publishers, everything has changed. So many of them are now wondering if they should try their hand at self-publishing. And I, whenever someone asks me, I tell them that, you know, you have to decide what you want to do with this. Like, you know, if you want to self-publish, what's your goal? Do you want to get more readers? Do you want to make money? Do you want to, like, you know, become famous? Do you want all three? You have to plan accordingly. So self-publishing has to be thought of a little more like a business, which I'm not very good at, to be honest. I don't know how Amazon ads work, and I haven't yet figured out, you know, whether I need to figure it, I need to do something about it or not. The one thing I feel I'm good at is writing. So I focus my energies on that. And that's what I'm doing.
And then the second wave hit in India, which was and you had a huge personal tragedy during the second wave. Can we talk about it? Do you feel comfortable talking about it?
So the second wave, when it started, it just felt like, you know, the first wave initially. We thought that, you know, we stayed low and that's what would happen this time also. So I don't know what happened. My older son got it first and I got COVID. And then we were both isolating in our rooms. And then my husband, mother-in-law and my younger son were like, you know, they were trying to take care of us. And then we discovered my mother-in-law was positive. So she isolated with me. She was not that old, you know, she was just not even 70, I think. Once our oxygen levels started dropping, it was a crazy time. We didn't know, you know, we didn't know when, whether we could get admission in hospitals, but we managed to get us admitted. Like, you know, my mother-in-law and I got admitted in one hospital and my husband was fine even until then, you know, and then like the next night he fell quite sick. So he got admitted in another hospital. And we never knew that this was the beginning of the end, you know. So it was that month was, I really never want to relive that month ever again in my life.
Okay, I understand. But you continue to write. You continue to write while you're processing
you
this
grief. You know, when
I was
in the hospital, when I was small, actually, when I was a small child, I used to think it would be really cool to get admitted in a hospital because then I'd be able to read as much as I wanted without anyone stopping me. And I realized that, you know, as with many things that you think as a child, you know, this is certainly overrated because even though I had my Kindle with me, even though I was reading, it was awful because I couldn't really focus on anything. There wasn't any sense of enjoyment in what I was reading because it was constant worries about what's happening, you know. I got discharged first and my husband and mother-in-law were still in, you know, both different hospitals. So I was running from this hospital to that hospital, trying to meet them, see them and all that. And I kind of felt that, you know, while I'm writing, I'm not thinking so much about everything that's going wrong. So it kind of helped me stay focused and, you know, get out of myself and into something else for whatever brief period of time. And then, of course, things started to worsen towards the end of May. My mother-in-law passed away. And the very next day, my husband was put on the ventilator. And of course, after that, everything was downhill. So, you know, we were waiting. Each day was like, it was just awful. And then when he passed away in early June, I was, of course, devastated. In a sense, I always used to think I lost my father when I was very young. You know, I was 12. So I felt that I've seen a huge loss in my life already, you know, so I can live through this. And of course, I did live through it, but I'm not saying it was easy. It was not easy. It was very difficult. And in those early days, I again, you know, opened my laptop and there were moments I was feeling guilty. I'm like, how can I sit and write, you know, when all this has happened, my whole world has crashed around me. But at the same time, I didn't know what else to do. I mean, there was nothing left to do. If either of them had survived, you know, we would have had something to do, as in take care of them or, you know, make sure that they were comfortable or whatever it was. But suddenly, so there was this huge, vast emptiness. And even though I have kids and people tell me I should live for my kids it's not something, you know, that's easy to it's not easy to do. But whenever I picked up my laptop and I went back to the writing, you know, when I went back to that world I was creating, it was more of sort of escapism. So earlier I used to escape, I use writing to escape from a very regular, boring life. And now I was just using it to escape from all this
realities,
trauma.
You call it escapism. I think it's more writing acted as a therapy for you.
Yes,
I think it was a healing.
I completely agree. It was definitely therapy because, you know, thinking of imaginary conflicts, you know, where, I mean, at times I used to think, who cares? Who cares if these two are separated by whatever, you know, society or whatever, who cares? And I was certainly not thinking of my readers, you know. But when I was sitting and, you know, when I was sitting and putting things together and writing those chapters and, you know, writing word after word, it helped me, you know, feel that maybe one day something, you know, that things can become normal.
So you also talk about how you were writing a romance novel at that time. Were you conflicted? You said you felt guilty as well.
Yeah,
earlier.
Because, you know, I'm writing about people who are destined to have this fabled happily ever after. And my whole life itself seemed to have imploded. So I felt very hypocritical writing that. So the thing is that whenever people asked me about, you know, so I write romance, but I also enjoy writing horror along with young adult. So young adult fiction. So a lot of people have asked me about, you know, because I write romance, they've always wanted to know what my relationship was like. And I would say, I would always tell people that it was very regular, run-of-the-mill, almost boring sort of relationship, which I guess, you know, in its own way, it was a sort of a blessing. You know, I mean, you realize all these things only when it's no longer there, right? So writing a romance is not difficult, you know. I'm very good at compartmentalizing my thoughts and feelings. I was just thinking, you know, so there were a couple of scenes which kind of really struck me very hard when I was writing it. But apart from that, it was not difficult, you know. Writing sometimes feels as natural as breathing. So I was just trying to breathe, you know, through that time.
That's brilliant. Writing is as natural as breathing. Now you've thrown yourself into new projects. You're writing more now. Can you talk about your new books?
Yeah, yeah.
What are you
so
working on?
So I finished that series, which I was working on last year. And with self-publishing, it's always nice to have a series. You know, because readers want to have that. They want to feel that connection with the characters even after the book is over. So they want to, you know, beyond the happily ever after, they want to see what, like, you know, so I always try and come up with connected series. And I came up with the idea of this series last year and I published the first book in October. And it's been doing well, you know, the first book of the series and the second book came out in December. And the third book came out yesterday. The thing is, the faster you write these series, it stays in the minds of the readers. They have, you know, a very short-term memory, I feel. So the longer I leave it, I think that immediacy of having that connection with the writer is also there if I bring out a book sooner. We're in this culture where, where binge-watching is like completely acceptable. It's something I can't bring myself to do because it's physically difficult for me to sit through and watch something, you know, an entire show of, say, 10 episodes. But that's the kind of culture that, you know, seems to have grown now. And people want to read. Like, the moment I finish this, they want to see what's next. So I'm okay with that because thankfully I can deliver. So I'm taking a few days break before I jump into the next book. So yeah, so writing has been great in that sense, you know, definitely gives me a sense of purpose. And also, writing and self-publishing is also my source of income. So I definitely get paid much more than I would get paid at a traditional publisher who pays advances and royalties whenever you've, you know, when they've recouped the advance, that's when you start getting royalties, which is very rare. But with self-publishing, it's different. And for me, it's also, so I treat my writing like a job. So it's, you know, I am my own boss and I'm a very strict boss. So that's why I get writing.
I can tell.
So I get so much writing done only because of that.
What is your take on Ann the Lib's interview, Stephanie? Do you have any thoughts?
I just admire quite a bit her resilience of being able to channel grief and loss into something so productive and profound. And I know that there's a healing property to kind of diving in deeper into work. The one thing I think it also speaks to is there's no better way to honor loved ones that have been lost than to honor their lives through appreciating life in a way. I think oftentimes people can be stuck in grief and loss and let it dwell too much on their lives and kind of let it overshadow what is still there. I really appreciated her perspectives on how she was able to channel that into something productive, but also to continue honoring life.
Yeah, exactly. That's how she took it. Yeah, she told me at one point that she felt writing was therapeutic for her, which is not surprising because she's always been using writing as a way to, you know, channel her feelings and channel her emotions. And she's still figuring out how self-publishing works, but it does feel like she is successful at self-publishing. I mean, if she's not successful, I don't think she'll be motivated to write more and more, right?
And I think one thing that she's doing that I think is really, really smart is that she's tethering between established publishing houses like Penguin and then being able to publish within self-publishing. So it allows readers to find her maybe in more mainstream ways. And then when they appreciate her writing, they can find some of the self-publishing where she might have more autonomy, more freedom to publish with greater frequency. At the same time, she could have the autonomy and freedom of schedule to be able to publish at her own rate.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this episode. If you like this episode, let us know by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts. And don't forget to follow us on your social media platform of choice and get notified when our next episode drops. Our website is recordofchange.com. Our theme music is Plasticity by Blue Dot Sessions. This episode was put together by Thomas Reinches, and my co-host has been Stephanie Rabel. I'm Pratap Nair. This episode would not have been possible without the help of Anhui Tran, Nimish Savan, and Matthias Jochmann. Until next time, stay safe.